I suspect that most Americans are not aware that retirement is a recent phenomenon. The truth is, before 1883, people did not retire. They just worked until they died, or they worked until they could not work any longer. It turns out that in 1883, Otto von Bismarck, who was a prime minister of Prussia, proposed that the government adopt a retirement system for the people in Prussia. Before that, there was no retirement system in Prussia. In fact, there was no retirement system in any government anywhere on the globe. Nowhere. Before that, there were a few retirement systems, but they're only for a select group of people, such as soldiers, police, firefighters, and teachers. And then in 1935, about 50 years later in the United States, the government established what we call Social Security, a retirement system. And the retirement system has been in force since then. And so today, we assume that retirement has always been around. We just expect that the government's going to give us some money in order to help us stop working. I get a certain age and I'm able to quit working, and then I just get to do whatever it is I want, have fun, travel, do whatever it is that I desire to do. But it's not been this way down through history. It's actually a recent phenomenon. A recent phenomenon started in Prussia, 1883, and then we picked it up in 1935, and it spread throughout the world. And lots of governments now offer a retirement system for the elderly. Interestingly enough, if you were to look at 1 Timothy chapter 5, you would find that there was a sort of a retirement system encouraged by the Apostle Paul. He gave instructions for widows, not for widowers, but for widows, not for families, not for couples, but for widows. Widows who are widows indeed, that they had no children, no children to care for them. And there was requirements in 1 Timothy chapter 5, verses 1 to 16. Paul said that the widow had to be at least 60 years or older. In other words, that they were younger and without a family, and younger without a husband, they had to go work. But if they were 60 or older, then the church should consider actually helping them, because they don't have any, watch this, any means of support. Because back in those days, if you had a husband, your husband worked, and so you were supported through your husband. Paul also mandated that they were married to one husband and not more, that they brought up children, that they were hospitable, that they assisted those who were in distress. Now, I thought the last requirement was kind of interesting. Assisted those who were in distress meant that they had to be dealing with people who actually were struggling with some issues. So this wasn't some woman who just decided to freeload through life, take the easy road through life, and just then come to the church and expect the church to pick them up if they had no husband or no children to actually support them. In fact, Paul in the passage makes the point that if they had children, it was the children's responsibility to support the parents. Paul makes that point in that passage. So this isn't really a retirement system, but this was a means of providing some support to widows who were widows indeed. They were without any kind of support. So that's the closest thing that you have to a retirement system in the Bible. Now, you're probably wondering, why am I talking about retirement when I'm dealing with Ecclesiastes chapter 2? Because our passage is about a man called King Solomon who is looking back over his life, and he is thinking about all of the things that he's done, and he's thinking about the fact that he's going to be leaving an inheritance to his children. And you might think, oh, he's in retirement, and he's thinking about leaving all of his stuff to his kids. And the answer is no, that's not the case. He is older, he is elderly at this point, I believe, and he is thinking about leaving the stuff that he has to his children, but he's still working. He hasn't quit. And so, what we're going to be looking at this morning is a third section in Solomon's findings. What we've pointed out in our last study is that the first 11 verses of chapter 1 is Solomon's theme for this book. In verses 12 through 18, he talks about his method of discovery, and that included looking at everything that had been done under the sun, and then everything that he looked at it with wisdom. And Scripture tells us that Solomon was the wisest man that had ever lived up to his time, and that he is the wisest man that will ever, ever live. So he is the epitome of wisdom. He's wiser than anybody who is living even today, is the message of Scripture. And so in verses 12 through 18 of chapter 1, he told us his method of discovery. He looked at everything and he evaluated everything. He evaluated what is the purpose of life, what do you get out of all of the activity that you are performing under the sun, and he looked at it with wisdom. Then starting in chapter 2, he started giving us some of his findings. In verses 1 through 11, he looked at pleasure. Then in verses 12 through 17, he looked at wisdom versus folly and wisdom versus the fool. And we made the point last time that the fool includes the naive, includes the scoffer, includes the sluggard, includes those who are mad, and includes being foolish. And so he looked at wisdom and the opposite of wisdom. And so this morning, we're going to be looking at the pursuit of labor. And so that's our study this morning. That's where we are going. And I trust this morning that as you follow the study, you're going to discover that there's no lasting satisfaction in pleasure, there's no lasting satisfaction in the pursuit of wisdom, and there's no lasting satisfaction in the pursuit of labor. There's no lasting satisfaction in anything that you are doing under the sun here on planet Earth. Our study this morning is Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verses 18 through 23. And he's going to share his conclusion about labor. We've already made the point that he's going to really say that even the labor doesn't bring you satisfaction. You might enjoy the labor, but it's not going to bring you the satisfaction that you're thinking. So let's pick it up in verse 18. That's where we're going to begin our study. In verse 18, he says, "And thus I hated all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun, for I must leave it to the man who will come after me." He makes a couple of important statements in this verse. And the first thing that is important for us to understand is the phrase, "the fruit of my labor." The translation of the Hebrew word is actually a phrase here in our English Bible. The phrase, "the fruit of my labor," is actually one Hebrew word. And the Hebrew word is amal. And it does not mean accomplishment, it does not mean projects or completed jobs. The New American Standard would lead us to believe that he's actually talking about the fruit of my labor, that is, the accomplishments of my work. In other words, I go off, I do something, and as a result of my doing, there's some project I complete, there's some job I complete, there is something I accomplish. That's not the meaning of the Hebrew word. The Hebrew word actually means trouble, or it can mean labor, it can mean toil, it can also mean suffering. The ESV, I think, does a great job of translating this well and talks about toil. And I think that's a good understanding of what he's trying to say. In other words, Solomon says, "Thus I hated all my toil." What's that? All your suffering. I hated all the suffering that I went through. All of the expenditure of effort. I painted my house on a number of occasions, inside as well as outside. And I'll tell you, I enjoyed the result. I enjoyed the job when it was done, but it was a lot of toil. It was a lot of suffering. I don't know what you have done in life. Maybe you've changed the tire on your car. Have you ever changed the tire on your car? You're glad when the job's done, but it's not fun changing a tire. He's not talking about the result or the end process of changing the tire. He's talking about the pain that you went through to change the tire. He says, "Thus I hated all my suffering, for which I suffered under the sun. for I must leave it to the man who will come after me. Now, obviously, the result of his suffering resulted in something that was accomplished, okay? So that's still true and still important in this verse. Now, I want to make you think about something for a second. Remember when Adam and Eve were put into the Garden of Eden? Do you remember in Genesis chapter 2, verse 15, that God put Adam in the garden? In verse 15, we're told that God told Adam that he was to cultivate and to keep it. Well, in chapter 2, there's no sin yet in the world. In chapter 2, sin has not yet occurred because sin did not enter the earth, did not enter the universe, did not enter the creation until chapter 3. It was chapter 3 when sin showed up. So in chapter 2, there's no pain and suffering. In chapter 2, there's no heartache. In chapter 2, it's just fun. In chapter 2, it's great. So when God put Adam in the garden in chapter 2, verse 15, and told him to cultivate and to keep it, that meant that the work was enjoyable. It wasn't toil and suffering. Think about what Solomon is saying. Solomon says, I hated all my, what? Suffering. But if it had been in Genesis chapter 2, he wouldn't have suffered. That should tell you something about what Solomon's thinking about. Solomon's starting to realize that this shouldn't be this way. In chapter 3, what did we find? Well, in chapter 3, Adam and Eve sin, and then God pronounces a curse on the woman, pronounces a curse on the man, and the curse on the man is also not only his relationship with his wife, but we read in Genesis chapter 3, verses 17 to 19, that cursed is the ground because of you. In toil, see the key word, you will eat of it all the days of your life. Both thorns and thistles it shall grow for you, and you will eat the plants of the field by the sweat of your face, and you will eat bread till you return to the ground, because from it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. What's the message? The message is that when Adam and Eve sinned, all of a sudden work became painful. Work became a toil. Work became suffering. And so Solomon says, I hated all my suffering. He understands that it shouldn't be this way. It's also interesting in Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 20. In Ecclesiastes verse 20, it says, for he does not think much about the fleeting days of his life, talking about us, for he, that is man, does not think much about the fleeting days of his life, because God keeps him preoccupied with the joy he derives from his activity. Now, what do you think that verse means? The verse is saying that God allows us to be preoccupied with the joy that we derive from our activity. What's that say? It says that you work, and you work, and you are suffering, you're experiencing pain, and you end up with an accomplishment, you end up completing a task, and you're happy about that task. That's what it's talking about. God keeps us preoccupied with the joy he derives from his activity. In other words, you work and you work and you work and you accomplish something, and what God has allowed us to do is to be fulfilled. He allows us to continue to be preoccupied with our joy of accomplishing something as a result of our suffering. Now, there's another important message in this verse, because the message is that we don't stop to think about the fleeting days of our life. Why? Because we're so busy enjoying the accomplishment of our suffering. You with me? So every day you have this list maybe of things that you want to do, or maybe it's one thing, or maybe it's a whole bunch of things, but there are things that you want to accomplish, there are things you want to do. Maybe it's just as simple as eating breakfast. Maybe it's eating a chocolate waffle that you like. Or, I don't know what it is, something that you wanted and you accomplish it and you go, wow, this is good. I enjoy doing this. What the verse is saying is that God allows you to just be consumed with enjoying the accomplishments of your work, and you don't stop to think about the meaning of life. You don't stop to think about the meaning of life. You don't stop to think about your purpose in life. You're just so preoccupied with enjoying the result of your suffering. That's what the verse says. And Solomon says, "Thus I hated all of my suffering for which I suffered under the sun." And then he tells us this very interesting statement. He says, got to leave it to somebody. When he says, labored under the sun, the phrase under the sun is used 28 times in Ecclesiastes. Used in every chapter except chapter 7, 11, and 12. And that should tell you what his focus is. He's talking about your labor here on planet Earth. You are working and working and working. You go to work, you do something, you clean the house, you fix a car. Whatever it is you're doing here under the sun, with its heat and its dirt, that you're doing all the stuff under the sun. And he says, and you're laboring. And he says, and I hate it. Because when I get done, I got to go leave it to somebody. So in verse 19, he says this. And who knows whether the man I'm going to leave it to is a wise man or a fool. Yet he will have control over my labor for which I have labored by acting wisely under the sun. This too is vanity, he says. His point is that you're going to leave it to somebody and you don't know if he's wise or she is wise. And yet, even though they might be wise or they might be a sluggard, they might be naive, they might be a scoffer, they might be mad, or they might just plain be a fool, they're going to have total control over whatever is I leave to them. And he says, and I worked really hard to achieve all of this. And I did it with wisdom. And he's already told us in the first 11 verses of chapter 2 that he built houses and vineyards and gardens and parks and planted fruit trees and he built ponds of water and he irrigated forests and he bought male and female slaves and all the stuff that he did. And he tells us that he didn't withhold anything from them. He did whatever it is he wanted. He's going to leave all this stuff to somebody, and he has no idea what they're going to really do with it. What a discouraging picture that he's painting here for us. I mean, that's his point, verse 20. He says, therefore I completely despair of all the fruit of my labor, all the fruit of my toil, all the fruit of my suffering for which I have suffered under the sun. Solomon says, I just utterly despaired. The word for despair is interesting. The Hebrew word means to have no hope or to give up hope. So he's thinking about all the stuff that he's done throughout his life and that he did it with wisdom. And he's thinking, he's reflecting on life and all the accomplishments. And he says, I'm going to leave it to somebody. And I've worked really hard. I'm going to leave it to a fool, maybe. And he's going to have total control. He says, I just completely gave up hope. I mean, what a horrible picture. You know, at this point, some people have said, Solomon doesn't have a loving heart. Some people have said, Solomon doesn't love his children. Solomon doesn't want to leave all of his possessions to somebody in his family. I don't think that's the case at all. Those who want to say that Solomon is unloving towards his children, I think they miss the point. That's not what he's saying. Watch this. Solomon does not hate his children. Solomon is not unloving towards his children. Solomon is being a realist about life. And you say, like, what's the real issue? Look at verse 21. And when there is a man who has labored with wisdom and knowledge and skill, and he gives his legacy to one who has not labored with them, this too is vanity and a great evil. That's why he doesn't want to leave it to somebody. That's why he does not want to leave it to his children. He says, I suffered with wisdom and knowledge and skill, and then I'm going to leave all of my legacy to somebody who hasn't labored, hasn't toiled. And he says, this is empty. If you remember, the word vain has the idea of emptiness. And I've referred to it as like a soap bubble. A soap bubble has nothing in it, and a soap bubble doesn't last. It goes pop. That's what a soap bubble does. He said, this is like a soap bubble. And then he adds, it's a great evil. The actual Hebrew means a great bad. So he says, this is bad. This is not good. This is bad. Think about it for a second. Solomon had great wisdom, had great knowledge, great skill. We're told that he was extremely wealthy. He expanded the borders of Israel like no king before him or after him. In fact, Israel was at its zenith in the expansion of his territory under King Solomon. I mean, King Solomon was a brilliant, brilliant king. Unbelievable individual. And here he's saying, I'm going to leave it to somebody, and I don't know if he's a wise man or if he's going to be a fool, and he's going to have total control, and he says, this is horrible. And I don't believe that what he's saying is that he does not love his children and does not want to leave anything to his kids. Let me help you get a handle on what I think he's struggling with. I think a few illustrations will be helpful. Some years ago, there was a couple here in our church. If I was to mention the name, I know that some of you would realize who they are. Turns out that he died before she died. She died within about a year. I can't remember exactly how long, but it was within a year. And I was contacted by their daughter, who started discussing with me funeral arrangements and being able to have a memorial service. And she wanted me to do something at the time of the burial, as well as having a memorial here at the church. So we were talking about doing that. And I discovered that one of the children had gained access to Mom and Dad's bank account. Apparently, Mom and Dad had some money in the bank account. They weren't wealthy, I know that. Probably not even moderate in their income. They were probably on the poor side, but they did have some money in the bank account. And it turns out that the daughter actually spent a fortune of the money that was in Mom and Dad's bank account. Bought TVs, bought furniture, bought all kinds of stuff. And it came out between the son and the daughter that that's what she did. And she ended up leaving nothing to anybody else. She took it all. She squandered it. She squandered it. That was bad. I was thinking about the daughter as I was going through the study. Was she a wise daughter or a foolish daughter? Was it wisdom to take the money and to squander it on herself? Proverbs would call her a fool. Doesn't know how to handle money, and the fact that she would ignore the rest of the siblings and hoard the money for herself says a whole lot about her integrity all by itself. That's all you need to really know. What a horrible situation. You know, this is the type of child I think King Solomon was concerned about. You leave it to some child, what are they going to do with all the money? I mean, children usually squander the money as it works out. I did some research this week. I discovered that the London Times reported on June 18, 2015, that most rich kids actually squander their parents' inheritance. They actually squander their inheritance from their parents. They take the money and they have some thing that they think is really good to spend it on, and they end up squandering it. In other words, they reason that, oh, we're entitled to this. Maybe we haven't had this. We really need it. It would be really helpful. We just do it one time. The only problem is that one time becomes repeated again and again and again. It isn't one time. It becomes a pattern until there's no money left. So they have some justification for a one-time spending, and then they got another justification for another spending, another justification for another spending. They justify another spending, and before you know it, there's no money left of the inheritance that they got. In fact, I read this week that of the children who have an inheritance from their parents that involves money, that within 19 days they buy a new car. That's the average. That should tell you something about how children handle the inheritance they get from their parents. Somehow they justify spending it, and they end up with nothing. Here's an example. Stephen Lovell inherited $70 million from his father. His father owned John Forsythe's shirt company, and his father owned a mansion in Ontario, Canada, owned a mansion in Southampton, New York, owned boats and airplanes and a hobby farm. A hobby farm, I guess, is a farm you don't really want a farm, but it's like fun. You have horses or whatever, and it's a hobby farm. So John Forsythe had a hobby farm, and what Stephen did is he lost it all, $70 million, spent it on things that were good to have, needed to have. It's reported that 70% of first-generation kids who inherit money from their parents lose it. By the time you get to the children's children, that's the second generation, 90% of the money is gone. That would mean by the time you get to the children's children, only 10% of the money is left. Now, is that wisdom? Not wisdom, that's being foolish. That's being a sluggard, or a naive, or a scoffer, or just plain a fool. One thing for sure, it's greed. Can you imagine Solomon? He's done all that he's done, and he's going to leave it to somebody who doesn't know whether he's wise or a fool. Wow, amazing. I went and checked out the Wall Street Journal, and I found that the Wall Street Journal gives the same kind of report, March 8, 2013, if you want to check it out. And I also found that there were a whole scat of other reports that echoed the same kind of a message. The truth is, most children who inherit money from their parents squander it. Hardly any of it is left. I think this is Solomon's grief, because he talks about he's going to leave all this stuff to somebody. He doesn't know whether they're wise or a fool. They're going to have total control. And I'm wondering, is he thinking about his son Rehoboam? Remember Rehoboam? Rehoboam inherited the kingdom from Solomon after Solomon died. If you check out 1 Kings chapter 11 through 12, we are told that he had some counselors come to him and give him some advice about a particular problem, and his counselors told him one thing and he did another, and he ended up splitting the kingdom. Foolish son. I'm just wondering, is Solomon thinking about Rehoboam when he writes this? I think if I was Solomon and I'm writing this and I'm being led by the Holy Spirit to write this so that what I'm writing is true and accurate, I would be thinking about my son or daughter or somebody in my family who I knew was foolish, and I'm just thinking about what's going to happen. I can't help but think that's what he's thinking about. In verse 22, we read this, "For what does a man get in all of his struggle, in all of his labor, and in the striving with which he labors under the sun?" So he says, what does a man get? So he's concerned about what's going to happen. I mean, he can't take it with him at death. And what's even worse is this stuff might get squandered. So you can't take it with you, and you're going to leave it, and it's going to get squandered. So I have a question for you this morning. Why are you working so hard? Why are you doing what you're doing? You say, oh, I need to put food on the table. Okay, that's true. You need a place to live. That's true. You need utilities for your place. That's true. You need a car so you can go to work. That's true. You need a job. That's true. I mean, think about all the things that you need, and why are you doing what you're doing? So that you can have a life here, so that you can keep going until you, what, die. So what do you get? Oh, I get to keep living until I die. Oh, okay, good. Is that your accomplishment in life, that you kept living until you died? That's what Solomon's asking. Like, what do I get? I die. That's what I get. Verse 23, because in all his days his task is painful and grievous, and even at night his mind does not rest. This too is vanity. This too is a soap bubble. He says, I work hard all the time. I work hard all the time, and at night, what happens with my mind? Actually, the Hebrew word can also mean heart. ESV changes mind out and makes it the heart, so the heart's pumping at night, and I think that might be a better translation. So the message would be, is even at night, my heart does not rest. It just keeps pumping and pumping and pumping and pumping. And so, like, what do you get? What do you get as a result of all your expended effort? You work in the day and you work at night. You really can't ever really truly rest. You're always doing something. Your body's always doing something. He says, this too is vanity. This too is empty. It's a soap bubble. It doesn't last. That's life. So what do we do as people here under the sun? Working and working and working and working. You say, oh, I get time with my kids. Okay. Yeah, but what did you accomplish? What did you accomplish? And if you're a Christian and you're going to die and you're going to go into heaven, like, what did you get? What did you get for all your labor here under the sun? I want you to think about a couple of things. First of all, our toil under the sun has no eternal reward. All your labor here under the sun has no eternal reward if it's for you. If it's all about you, there's no eternal reward. Look at Proverbs 13:22. It says, a good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children, and the wealth of the sinner is stored up for the righteous. Now, this is an important verse. Some years ago, a man came to me. He was attending the evening service. He walked up to me and he said, should I leave an inheritance to my children? He said, people are telling me I shouldn't. I should just spend it all. Some are telling me that I need to leave an inheritance. He asked me, he said, what should I do? What does the Bible tell me? What does the Bible tell me I should do with my money? And I gave him Proverbs 13:22. It says, a good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children. Notice what it says. It doesn't say a good man leaves an inheritance to his children. It says to his children's children. So when my wife and I, we made out our will, guess what we did? We made sure that there is an inheritance to our children and that there's an inheritance to our grandson or grandchildren. Right now we have only one. So we made sure that there was an inheritance to our grandchildren, is the point. And this says a good man does that. I believe that Solomon left an inheritance to his children. What he was grieving was, are they going to be wise or foolish? And what are they going to do with it? And then he's looking at his own life and saying, like, what does he accomplish? He can't take it with him. And what he's going to leave might get squandered by the child. And that's exactly what happened to Solomon's wealth. His son, Rehoboam, squandered it. Squandered the kingdom. Not necessarily squandered all the wealth. But what's amazing is to realize that in our culture and around the world is that most children, when they get an inheritance from their parents, they squander it. That's the pattern. And it's not just 20%, it's not 50%, it's 90% by the time you get to the children's children. Just tells you about how wise we are and how greedy we are with our money. A good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children. You know what we should do then as parents? Is we need to make sure that we leave an inheritance, whatever it is, might be a lot, might be a little bit, but something to your children and then to your children's children. A good man does that, okay? Now, let's go back. Question is, what can we accomplish? We've seen this passage before. I want you to see it again. Because if nothing else is important, this is important. It says, "Therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your toil is not in vain in the Lord." Isn't it interesting that it uses the word vain? The message is really simple, is that if you want what you are doing to count for eternity, do it for the Lord. I avoided the phrase under the sun. I almost said that. If you want it to count for eternity, do it for the Lord. That is the message. And that's exactly been my heart's attitude, is that everything that I do counts for the Lord. Everything I do in my home, everything I do for my children, I think about what would the Lord want me to do. How I spend my money, I think about what would the Lord want me to do. Whatever it is I'm doing, I want it to count for the Lord, and as a result, that is not in vain, and it counts for eternity. What Jesus tells us in Matthew chapter 6, verse 21, and I'll close with this verse. He says this, "For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." And in the passage, he's talking about laying up treasures here on earth or treasures in heaven. So where are you laying up your treasure? Are you laying up treasure here on earth? Are you laying up treasure in heaven? Why are you doing what you're doing? That's a good question. If it's for yourself, it's a soap bubble. Let's pray.